Radio MD.
RadioMD.com.
Talk about getting healthy. This is the place. You're listening to Talk Healthy Today with Dr. Jeffrey Burke.
So today, do you have a lot of seemingly random gastrointestinal problems? You know, we see a lot of television commercials, you know, on many of these things every day. Things like skin outbreaks, headaches, joint pain, mood swings, they seem all too common. Have your doctors looked for a reason or a cause only to come up empty? Have some even suggested that, well, maybe it's all in your head? Well, rest assured, it may not be. Instead, you may be suffering from a food sensitivity. Today I'll be talking with Roger Deutsch, the man behind the ALLCAT food sensitivity test, to discover how food can elicit an adverse immune response in some of us. You'll learn how food sensitivities can affect your health and even your weight. And you'll finally learn the difference between a food sensitivity, a food intolerance, and a true food allergy, and how you can find out, you know, where you fit. Roger Deutsch is the founder and the CEO of Cell Science Systems in Deerfield, Florida, and ALLCAT Europe in Berlin, Germany. As one of the pioneers of food and chemical sensitivities testing, he has been responsible for the commercialization of the ALLCAT food sensitivity test throughout the world. Roger is also the co-author of Your Hidden Food Allergies Are Making You Fat. Help me welcome my guest, Roger Deutsch. Hey, Roger, how are you?
Yeah, hello, Dr. Burke. How are you?
I am wonderful. I'm so glad you're here today. This is such a large issue, but the information is still coming out at a snail's pace. But one thing that's not coming out as a snail pace are the complaints that we have with many of the areas that food sensitivities radiate from. And I like the idea of maybe clarifying a little bit for people, you know, maybe the difference between things like food sensitivity, food intolerance, and a real true food allergy. Because some people say, I am allergic to dairy. And then they dead set know that. Can we talk a little bit about actual sensitivities and intolerances?
Yes, absolutely. That's a good question. Allergy, you know, of course, these are all terms.
Of course.
So, it, you know, if people agree on what they mean, then it's clear in the communication. Allergy was a term coined back in 1906 by an Austrian physician named von Perquet. And he intended it to mean altered reaction. So that would be very broad. But the physicians in Europe at that time, especially getting into the 30s, wanted a more precise definition. And they decided to restrict the term allergy with respect to food to only those kind of reactions that are immediate. Mm-hmm. And they attributed the cause of these to a substance they called reagent, and they didn't know what it was. Now, back, fast forward to the 60s, they identified that it was an antibody called IgE. And the characteristics of this IgE have now been very well studied and very well documented. And the features of a true food allergy are that the symptoms occur very rapidly, and they can be very dramatic. And the pathways that are involved are the same pathways that defend us against infection from worms. Mm. Now, if you think about that, a worm is much bigger than an immune cell. And, of course, I'm referring to immune cells because that's what defends us against foreign invaders. So in order to counteract the effect of the worm, the immune cell must do something very dramatic. And what it does is it spews out large amounts of histamine and then other chemicals. And, of course, histamine causes the symptoms we associate with allergy, sneezing, smooth muscle contractions, so a person can have airways closing up, irritation to the nerve ending, so a person feels very uncomfortable, and there can be pain and itching. So if you have a true allergy to a food, it's more dramatic and it's more immediate, and you usually don't need a test. So these are the kind of things like a peanut allergy, where a person might suffer anaphylaxis. Now, in contrast, there are a number of different types of reactions, that we'll generically call adverse reactions to foods that are not classical or true allergies, but they're real. And their onset can be delayed by minutes, hours, or even a few days. And the symptoms tend to be more chronic and low grade. So it could be an occasional migraine headache. It can be a skin rash. It could be respiratory issues. It could be metabolic disorders. And because it's delayed and it's more chronic, the linkage between the ingestion of the food or groups of foods that cause it and the symptoms are not easily identifiable. So it hasn't received, up until recently, as much recognition, and therefore it's not as well understood as true allergy. But nonetheless, it's real. It has to be addressed. And that's what we've been working on for the last 30 years.
Now, let me ask you a question. Two things that come right to mind for me. Did we have as many of these sensitivities, intolerances, and allergies, I don't know, 4 or 5 decades ago when food was still kind of food? Or have we noticed more of them today when food is kind of like food stuff, you know, and chemicals and processing and the things that we have in our everyday diet today? The things that on the general side most people gravitate toward, are we seeing an influx in today's world?
I think that's a good point. I think the answer is that yes, food sensitivity is more common today than it was 50, 60, 70 years ago. After World War II, we started to use pesticides, which we didn't use before that. And it's interesting why we started to use them. The Germans and the Americans had a lot of leftover toxins that were used in biological warfare, and they decided, well, we could sell these to the farmers. So that started, and artificial fertilization of the soil and really creating plants that were more on life support than natural hardy plants that developed their own internal defenses against pests and antioxidants and so forth. So there's less nutrition in the food and there's more foreignness. And this can throw the body a curveball, and it's the immune system's job to address it. And then when the immune system gets activated, we can see the symptoms that you were listing, rashes, respiratory joint pain, so on and so forth. So it is seeming to be a modern disease.
Now, you know, the other thing is, do we progressively through our lifetime come in and out of these stages? Are they things that we may possibly build up a tolerance to maybe one food sensitivity, and then maybe develop another one to another group that for maybe a long period of time never posed an issue?
Things can shift. One of the paradigms is that a sensitivity to food is actually sort of a pharmacologic or toxic reaction. Now, remember, foods contain chemicals, and by intention, plants contain chemicals that are toxins because they want to protect themselves from pests and so forth. And if it's new to us, meaning that it's not something that's been on our ancestors' repertoire of normal things to be exposed to and eating for perhaps thousands of generations, it may be that we lack sufficient detoxification capacity. And so if we eat too much of something, the detoxification pathways are inadequate, and then the immune system kicks in. And that immune system kicking in produces inflammation and can manifest in these different symptoms. So it can shift around depending on exposures. Mm-hmm. There are chemicals in foods that are similar to other foods or to even pollen in the air, and these cofactors might aggregate and push one over the edge and induce a tolerance where there wasn't a tolerance before.
Now, we tend today, you know, obviously C-reactive protein tests are done as part of a blood workup because many things that we do today are inflammatory based. Are these sensitivities, tolerances, food allergies, are they things that cause more inflammation. And then, of course, more inflammation causes obviously many of these symptoms that we have that could be different for many people. But are they inflammatory?
Yes. There's a study, and it's been presented. It's going into publication. That was performed recently in Northern Illinois University. And there was a report on the internet just the other day. It may still be there. Looking at patients who were tested with the ALCAT test, who had symptoms of food sensitivity, they were evaluated at the outset, and included in the study if they had inflammatory conditions. And half the group followed a true ALCAT test diet, and the other group, and everybody was blinded, followed a sham diet. And what they did was measure. They did a number of things. They measured disease inventory scores on a survey. They looked at body composition. And they also looked at a blood marker, which is probably supplanting high-sensitivity CRP for a measurement of acute inflammation. It's called serum amyloid A. And what they saw was that versus baseline, the people who followed the true ALCAT diet had an enormous drop in this inflammatory marker. So it's clear that there's an inflammatory component going on there, and it can be triggered by, of course, foods.
Talk a little bit about the ALCAT, the test. How does this work? Because, I mean, I've been reading and studying about it. It's very advanced and it's very technical, but there's got to be a way that people can maybe understand a little bit of the overview of the ALCAT test.
Sure. The concept of the test essentially is that these reactions are mediated by immune system cells. And so what we do in the test is collect the blood from the patient, and we separate out the immune cells. And we add back plasma, and we then culture it in a well with a food or a chemical. And some wells we leave with just the patient cell sample, and we do an analysis on each well, or each aliquot, as we would say. And we look at the size distribution of the cells. How many cells are there in a defined quantity of the blood? And what size are they? And then we look at them after they've been exposed to the food or the chemical and see if the chemical has caused the cells to swell up or actually disintegrate. And if they do, we found that that observation in the well does apply to real life. And another interesting finding just recently came from some evaluations at Yale School of Medicine. And they did the ALCAT procedure and looked to see what else was going on. We're seeing a change in the size of the cells and the number of the immune cells. And what's actually happening? What they found was that when the cells are disintegrating, they're releasing DNA fragments because the cell is severely damaged and killed. Goes through a process of destruction of the cell, necrosis or apoptosis, other terms. And DNA, which is inside the cell, both inside the nucleus and the mitochondria, the organelles that provide energy, get destroyed, and the DNA fragments leak out. And what's been found is that these DNA fragments cause further inflammation to occur, and also autoimmunity. So what we're doing is looking at, do the cells respond to the presentation of this food extract or food additive or chemical inside the well under conditions that are designed to reflect what's happening under normal exposure or natural exposure. And then we get a report and we see how strong the reaction was, and we categorize that as either mild or severe, and a person gets a report which is fairly straightforward. The food is in the red column. It has to be avoided for probably a long time, or it's in the orange column, and it's pretty severe, and you have to avoid that at least for 3 or 6 months, or it's a food that doesn't show or induce a reaction in the cells, and you can eat it freely.
Now, you know, I'm thinking to myself, and I'm thinking about this question is really perplexing me. We today are hearing so much about gluten sensitivities, and, you know, is that one of the trigger food categories today? Are we truly seeing gluten allergies and sensitivities, or has it become kind of a way of living for people and they've maybe jumped on the bandwagon?
There is a lot of evidence that gluten is a major problem.
Okay.
And if the genetics are wrong, it can progress into full-blown celiac disease,
okay,
which is an autoimmune disease where the immune system starts destroying the villi in the small intestine, and the person can no longer absorb nutrients properly and becomes malnourished. But short of celiac, if a person doesn't have the genes or the other cofactors, gluten has been shown to cause what they call non-celiac gluten sensitivity. And there is a whole range there, and there are papers coming out all the time about identifying how it's causing damage to the lining of the intestinal wall and so forth. So gluten, by the nature of its chemistry, because it's very, very difficult to break it down, just the chemistry of gluten is complicated and contains... This gets a little technical, and no one needs to remember this, but it contains a lot of proline and glutamine, and the body can't digest that. And so the immune system reacts to gluten probably more than just about any other food that's common in the diet. So I believe that gluten sensitivity is quite real.
Okay. Next question. Are there food categories that are pretty standard that are fitting this group of sensitivities and allergy problems? And are we seeing certain categories be, you know, reflected more than other kind of food groups? I mean, are we seeing, you know, individual, you know, groupings of these, and are we seeing them all over the place, or are we talking environmental and geographical differences?
That's a great question. You know, so much goes into how the human adapts to their environment.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a lot to do with their immune system and their genetics and what they're exposed to and their general level of health and their detoxification capabilities, which are impacted by their genetics very much, but also by their nutritional status. And then the gut ecology. There's a universe of different kind of microorganisms, mostly bacteria, but also others, viruses and protozoa, that live inside our gut, and some of them are good and some of them are bad. Mm-hmm. And they're constantly talking back and forth with the immune system. And some things can actually trigger a reaction in a person who has the same genes as their identical twin, but has developed a different gut ecology, and their immune system can respond differently. So what that means is that any food can be a problem for any individual, and it's very difficult to predict. So the short answer to your question, I think, is that there's not a group of foods that are the biggest culprits.
Mm-hmm.
Although, you know, gluten-containing grains are definitely out there. Casein in milk, a protein in milk, is a problem. Certain types of short-chained fatty acids, the FODMAP, so to speak, fructooligodisaccharides and phenols, can not be digested very well, and it can cause some irritation and discomfort in the bowel. But anything could be a problem for anybody, and it's very difficult to try and make those generalizations that people in this region of the country or this region of the world will tolerate strawberries or not tolerate strawberries. It's very individual and affected by so many different factors.
You know, today we're talking about food allergies, food sensitivities, and things that we need to be made aware of, because a lot of the little things that we may be perplexed with every single day may be directly related to some of these problems. So if you want to see what's coming up next on our show, like us on Facebook page, follow us on Instagram and Twitter, let us know what your favorite healthy habit is, then listen in. You might just hear it mentioned right here on the show. And let's face it today, walking into most health food stores can boggle the brain. Faced with shelf after shelf of supplements, how do you know what to choose? Better Nutrition can help. Better Nutrition is the healthy shopping magazine, packed with useful information on a variety of health topics, as well as deliciously healthy recipes and good-for-you lifestyle tips. Every issue will help you stay up to date on the best products and advice for optimal wellness. Pick up your copy of Better Nutrition at fine health food stores near you today. Now, a little bit of background information that's available to you. Some books you might want to look at. Of course, Your Hidden Food Allergies Are Making You Fat. This is a book that you should have and you should be reading and rereading, because it's going to bring you great information. It's How to Lose Weight and Gain Years of Vitality by my guest, Roger Deutsch and Rudy Rivera. Another book, Why Can't I Have Cupcake by Betsy Childs. And then a couple small places you might want to visit, foodsmatter.com. And of course, cellsciencesystems.com. Really some places to kind of give you some good information, because I know so many of us are searching for information.
Now, Dr. Burke, at cellsciencesystems.com.
Systems.com. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. We want to make sure everybody gets there and gets the information. You know, these are great references, and your book is awesome. And it really does hit home. I mean, let's talk about that a little bit. You know, today we are all trying to figure out why we as a nation are so much bigger than we used to be. And obviously, if you take a look at what we're consuming, that's part of it. Being stuck behind computers and electronic devices and not being active, obviously another factor. But there may be things that we may not even know could be making us fat.
Absolutely. The pathway is about the connection between inflammation and metabolic disorders are becoming clearer and clearer. And science is making tremendous advances in that. And it's just all over the internet now. And the latest finding about the DNA is a paper that just came out about 2 weeks ago, that the DNA fragments actually activate the innate immune system through certain kind of receptors. But the impact is really when the cells, and that again is why we do that measurement of the cells with the ALCAT test, when the cells release certain inflammatory chemicals that are part of these inflammatory cascades, they actually block insulin receptors. So even if you're eating a diet that's not high in fat, but it's not right for you, for your genetics, for your gut microbiome, for your immune system, for all these different factors, the way you are right now, and it triggers inflammatory responses from your cells, it blocks insulin receptors. So when you consume food and it is broken down into simple sugars, it's not able to be taken up as effectively by the cells and expended for energy. And you feel sort of tired. But then, and also, these sugars are stored then as fat. And so what we see, and that's why the book was written. The book came following a study from Baylor Medical College, which showed that people following a diet based on the ALCAT test, or at least 98% of them, showed significant improvement in body composition and or their scale weight within a month. And a control group that was restricting calories actually got fatter. And so this was published in a scientific journal, and then Random House asked me if I would write a book about that. And so I did. And the book is older. Getting old right now, and it needs some updating, but I think it still was one of the first books to where I pretty carefully reviewed the literature, and I was able to explain, you know, why that happens. And it has to do with the immune system affecting metabolism in a negative way, and that basic concept is still quite important.
Let me pose another question to you, and this has to do with the idea of our craving centers. Obviously, our palates today have become quite strong and quite verbal about the foods that they want us to consume, although our brains and our hearts know many times those are the things we most likely should not be eating. Our palates usually end up winning out. But real quick, just a because I know we're up against the time here, do you think that our cravings sometimes make us eat foods that we shouldn't be eating?
All the time.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's what
when, again, when there's inflammation, unwanted inflammation has a lot of faces and a lot of negative attributes, and one of them is that it alters our biochemistry, and it can cause specifically a deletion or depletion of serotonin levels. And serotonin levels make us feel good and satisfied, and when it gets depleted, the way to unconsciously we want to bring it back up again, and eating sugary food will do that. So a lot of times people can avoid a food which itself is not a sugary food but is causing inflammation and depletion of serotonin, and then the cravings, and you eliminate that food, and then the cravings resolve.
You know, today we're talking with Roger Deutsch, and we're talking about food allergies, food sensitivities, and, you know, some of the little red signals that we should be looking for, because I think sometimes we may not even be aware that our body is allergic or having a sensitivity or can't digest well or process some of the things that we may have been eating, you know, maybe even in excess or maybe even once in a while our entire life. We have to have a better idea, and, you know, reading good information and reading the books that are available, I think you really will learn a lot. I'm Dr. Jeffrey Burke, and this is the Talk Healthy Today show on Radio MD. For more information on this and all of the segments, visit the show page at RadioMD.com for on-demand podcast listening. Thank you for listening, and stay well.